basic services in Afghanistan are collapsing and food and other life-saving aid is about to run out.
Helping Afghanistan's most vulnerable. It's Thursday, September 9th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Chris Cascale in Washington. You'll also find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, women prosecutors fear the Taliban. Vaccine efficacy against long COVID. Remembering 9/11, airport security. Guantanamo Bay terror suspects on trial. U.S. veterans reflect on Afghanistan. It's all on today's VOA Asia. UN officials will meet next week to discuss a plan to raise $606 million for life-saving humanitarian assistance for nearly 11 million people in Afghanistan until the end of the year. VOA's Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warns Afghanistan is facing a looming humanitarian catastrophe. The UN chief will travel to Geneva to convene next Monday's meeting to gain the support of the international community to address the growing needs in the country. The United Nations reports nearly half of Afghanistan's population of 38 million needs humanitarian aid. Among them are 3.5 million people internally displaced by conflict. The UN Children's Fund reports 600,000 children under age 5 are suffering from severe acute malnutrition, a dangerous condition that could kill them if they do not receive emergency aid. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says the appeal will provide treatment for more than 1 million children and women suffering from acute malnutrition. He says the appeal also aims to deliver critical food, essential health services, water and sanitation, emergency education, shelter, and other relief.
Humanitarian organizations have decades of experience in delivering relief in Afghanistan. This year alone, 8 million people have received assistance. But basic services in Afghanistan are collapsing, and food and other life-saving aid is about to run out.
The World Food Program reports 1 in 3 people in Afghanistan is going hungry. WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says the humanitarian crisis unfolding in the country will worsen during the fast-approaching winter season. He says WFP is racing to pre-position food before the snow cuts off access to large areas of the country.
In just a few weeks, sadly, our food will run out. We have called for resources and we are urgently requiring $200 million to assist 14 million people between now and the end of 2021. The need to get timely contributions whilst we still have a window of opportunity to bring in food.
UN agencies vow to remain in Afghanistan and provide humanitarian aid despite increasing insecurity under Taliban rule. UN officials say they have been present in the country for nearly 4 decades and have experience in working with different authorities, even the Taliban, when the militant group last held power between 1996 and 2001. The UN assures international donors none of their money will end up in government hands. UN officials say all money is channeled to implementing agencies on the ground who will put it to good use. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Myanmar's shadow government announces defensive war. South Korea fights fake news, but critics claim it's gagging the press. New Zealand to overhaul terror laws after Auckland supermarket stabbings. China chases rejuvenation with control of tycoons and society. Hong Kong police arrest organizers of annual Tiananmen Square vigils. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA VOA Asia continues. The Taliban on Tuesday announced an all-male interim government for Afghanistan, stacked with veterans of their hardline rule from the 1990s and the 20-year battle against the U.S.-led coalition. The move seemed unlikely to win the international support the new leaders desperately need to avoid an economic meltdown. Appointed to the key post of interior minister was Sirajuddin Haqqani, who is on the United States' most wanted list with a $5 million bounty and is believed to still be holding at least one American hostage. He headed the feared Haqqani network that is blamed for many deadly attacks and kidnappings. Meanwhile, female prosecutors in Afghanistan fear the Taliban and thousands of prisoners released by the militant group. These women who are still in Afghanistan are calling on the international community for help. VOA's Farkunda Paimani reports.
The female employees of the Attorney General's office in Kabul say that their lives are in danger. They say that they fear for their lives under the Taliban because the group has claimed the killings of many prosecutors and government officials in the past 20 years. These Afghan prosecutors want the international community to help them relocate to a safer place.
Certainly, we do not feel safe. We could not even go out of our houses. We do not have peace of mind at any time. We want the international community to seriously make a decision about women, especially prosecutors, because their lives are in danger. Every moment it's possible that they are being assassinated.
Female prosecutors say that they also feel threatened by the thousands of prisoners who were released by the Taliban last month when the group took control of the country.
We feel threatened not only by the Taliban, but also by the prisoners who were released. We have videos and documents that show that the Taliban have said they will target prosecutors. Some of our colleagues have already received messages and calls from those who were in prison, saying that they will take their revenge. Therefore, we do not feel safe at all.
Female prosecutors are also concerned that the Taliban would roll back the gains made in women's rights in the past two decades in Afghanistan, including the rights to work.
I do not think that under the new government, women would be able to resume their work. It is possible that some women, such as physicians and teachers, would be allowed to work.
Last month, the Taliban urged women to stay home, calling it a temporary measure to protect women until the group could come up with a new procedure. The Taliban have said that they are not against women's education and work, but women activists are deeply skeptical of the militant promises. Farhunda Paimani, VOA News, Washington.
Still ahead on VOA Asia, new research about vaccines and so-called long COVID. Happening now in Asia, Indonesia's Justice and Human Rights Minister visited the site of a massive fire in an overcrowded prison near Jakarta that burned early Wednesday, killing at least 41 inmates and injuring 80 others. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us on VOA Asia. The summer that was supposed to mark the United States' independence from COVID-19 is instead drawing to a close with deaths per day back up to where they were in March. The Delta variant is filling hospitals, sickening alarming numbers of children and driving coronavirus deaths in some places to the highest levels of the entire pandemic. School systems that reopened their classrooms are abruptly switching back to remote learning because of outbreaks. Legal disputes, threats, and violence have erupted over mask and vaccine requirements. The U.S. death toll stands at more than 650,000, with one major forecast model predicting it will top 750,000 by December 1st. New research shows that coronavirus vaccines not only offer protection against infection and serious illness, but may also help prevent so-called long COVID, where symptoms can last for weeks or months. VOA's Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
South African factory manager Bradley Solomons caught COVID-19 in July last year and spent more than 20 days in hospital. Months later, he was still struggling with daily life.
I still feel that sometimes I lose my memory for 3 to 5 minutes and I don't know what I was doing or whatsoever, and I still cough Now and then my throat is still sore.
There are no official figures, but it's thought millions of people worldwide who contracted the coronavirus have also suffered from so-called long COVID, with symptoms lasting longer than 4 weeks. The condition remains poorly understood, says British campaigner Ondine Sherwood.
Amongst medical practitioners, there is a bit of variation in terms of recognition. I think people are still getting told that it's due to anxiety. Some doctors don't really fully understand this condition.
New research from King's College London suggests that coronavirus vaccines halve the risk of suffering from long COVID for the very low number of people who get infected after vaccination. The scientists based their research on Britain's Zoe COVID study app, which tracked the self-reported symptoms of 1.2 million people between December 2020 and July this year. 0.2% of vaccinated respondents reported being infected with coronavirus. Of those, 5% reported suffering from long COVID, compared to 11% of unvaccinated people.
So the vaccine will protect you from becoming ill from the virus. It will also protect you, if you do get symptoms, from becoming long-term ill from this virus.
The findings will fuel the debate over whether to offer vaccines to children. Another recent study in Britain found that 1 in 7 children suffers from long COVID 3 months after infection, with headaches and fatigue listed as the most common symptoms. Several countries, including the US, have already begun vaccination programs for those 12 years and over. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Ultra-conservative former Japanese Internal Affairs Minister Sanae Taikaichi, a protege of former leader Shinzo Abe and former Foreign Minister Fumio Kishida, announced their candidacies Wednesday to succeed outgoing Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. As the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks approaches, VOA's Julie Tabo looks at some of the technology that works to keep U.S. airports safe.
Thomas Carter remembers the horror he felt watching planes crash into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center.
To watch those events unfold before my eyes, you knew that nothing would ever be the same.
Carter is now a federal security director at the Transportation Security Administration, the U.S. federal agency that oversees the nation's airports. He says the mission to make airports safer has, in recent years, increasingly turned to technology.
Technology is a key facet of our counterterrorism mission, and it's one of our key tools.
That technology, often invisible to the traveler moving through checkpoints, can include scanners that use algorithms to analyze a suspicious item inside a bag. Light waves checking liquids for explosives. And, coming to an airport near you, biometrics, such as facial recognition technology that can help confirm a person's identity. The AIT, or Advanced Imaging Technology Machine, considered the workhorse of checkpoint security, scans the contours of the body using millimeter wave technology, radio waves passing through clothing, looking for anything unusual, such as explosives or bomb-making equipment.
If you were a suicide bomber, you would have to place that device somewhere on your person. This machine allows us to detect that.
Some of the latest airport security technology comes from the medical industry. The computed tomography machine works like a magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI machine, giving inspectors a 3D view that can be rotated 360 degrees.
Which allows our officers to get an extremely high-definition, high-resolution image.
Looking to the future, Carter says there may come a day when travelers scan themselves into the checkpoint with limited touching and mainstream use of biometrics.
That includes facial recognition, retina scanning, or fingerprints.
The 20th anniversary of 9/11, Carter says, will be a day of remembrance, reflection, and a renewal of purpose, especially as he looks to the Freedom Tower in Manhattan, built where the Twin Towers once stood.
We know that that represents the strength of our nation, and we know that we have a mission ahead of us to protect it.
Advanced technology and extra patience from passengers worldwide all can help in the mission to keep air travel safe. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, mobile COVID-19 vaccinations using buses have begun in Thailand, with the first launching in central Bangkok, in a program that the government of Thailand hopes to expand to rural, isolated areas. Stay up to date with VOA or listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, 20 years since the attacks of September 11th, the Guantanamo Bay detention camp, which at its peak held almost 800 terror suspects, is now home to fewer than 40 detainees. Some are only now being brought to trial, as reported by VOA's Yuni Salim in this report narrated by Nova Porwadi.
18 years since he was captured in a CIA-backed operation in Thailand, Indonesian terror suspect Encep Nurjaman, also known as Hambali, was finally arraigned Tuesday at a military trial held at the U.S. detention camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, along with two terror suspects from Malaysia, Muhammad Nazir bin Lep and Muhammad Farik bin Amin. Hambali was indicted on 9 counts of terrorism related to the Bali nightclub bombings of 2002 that killed more than 200 people. The three suspects did not enter a plea, citing the lack of clear translations during the arraignment.
If the translation into Malay is insufficient. Let's imagine, just for sake of ease, only every third word is translated into Malay. Then it is a deficient arraignment because he wasn't advised of the charges.
The defense also questioned the objectivity of one of the translators.
We have an affidavit sworn under penalty of perjury or delivered under penalty of perjury in which a witness will say that one of the interpreters, regarding Guantanamo detainees generally, and our clients in particular, she commented, "I don't know why the government is wasting so much money on these terrorists. They should have been killed a long time ago."
Hambali is a key figure in the Al-Qaeda-linked Southeast Asian terror group Jemaah Islamiyah, the group behind the 2002 bombings in Bali. His defense team asked for the trial to be adjourned to gather more evidence and witnesses, considering the length of time that has passed between the crime and the defendant's capture in 2003. The presiding judge, Hayes Larson, approved the defense's request for an adjournment.
We're still building an attorney-client relationship, right? We've only been on these cases for about a year and a half. And so, you know, we couldn't see our clients for the past year and a half.
The existing links among Southeast Asian terror groups, such as the one Hambali led to Al-Qaeda, is one concern for terror experts with the recent Taliban takeover of Afghanistan.
The leaders of many militant groups in Indonesia and elsewhere, Malaysia, the Philippines, were veterans of the Mujahideen that fought the Soviet Union, that were later recruited by Al-Qaeda.
Hambali is among 39 remaining terror suspects detained at Guantanamo, but not for long. The Biden administration has said it has been looking at options for transferring the detainees and shutting down the detention camp. For Yuni Salim at Camp Justice Guantanamo, I'm Nova Purwadi, VOA News.
Finally on VOA Asia, in 2002, VOA's Kane Farabaugh, then a reporter for the U.S. military, visited Afghanistan in the early stages of America's 20-year presence in the country. With the U.S. military engagement now over, Farabaugh follows up with those he met in those early years to discuss the U.S. withdrawal and the mission's legacy.
Lawrence Taylor worked as an air traffic controller in San Jose, California on September 11th, 2001. Just 4 months later, he was among the first uniformed members of the military on the ground at Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan.
When we showed up, the tower itself, it wasn't in the best condition. The floor was all damaged. The ceiling had a mortar hole in it. We came here with basically nothing, and we set up an air traffic control facility from the ground on up.
When I first met Taylor in May of 2002, serving with the U.S. Air National Guard in Afghanistan, flight operations at Bagram Airfield had picked up pace as about 7,500 service members were deployed to the country. Most serving at the time of my reporting assignment for the American Forces Network were part of Operation Enduring Freedom, the military's official name for the mission to eliminate the Al-Qaeda terrorist network that used Afghanistan as a haven to launch attacks.
As a guard unit going out and doing this stuff, this is the first time that we've ever done this.
Archer 564 is negative contact, 2-way comms with traffic.
Steve Hutcherson was working the radar system at an aviation facility in St. Joseph, Missouri during the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks.
How's our flash doing? Is he getting ready to launch?
When I visited him in a radar trailer near the flight line of Bagram Airfield in 2002, he had been in country nearly 5 months.
You're a part of it. You're not just watching it on TV and now you're over here and actually, you know, part of, you know, getting things straightened out. I don't know. It's a pretty patriotic thing.
Hutcherson's first combat deployment wasn't his last.
Was home for about 6 months, and then we got the call again, and we got to go over to Iraq and spend a little bit of time over there.
It wasn't hard to track down Hutcherson 19 years after we first met. He still works for the same air traffic control squadron in Missouri he deployed with in Afghanistan and Iraq. Only now, he's a civilian with the unit after retiring from the Air National Guard.
People in now, they've known nothing but Afghanistan, and nothing had really changed since when we first went in there and we took control of the areas and everything.
Hutcherson says he wasn't surprised by the rapid advance of the Taliban in regaining control of Afghanistan.
I would have been more surprised if we watched the news and saw the Afghan army fighting the Taliban. That would have shocked me much more.
But Hutcherson doesn't believe the end result changes the success of the mission.
The mission was to stop another 9/11 style attack. And it's been 20 years since it happened, and we haven't had one. And really, I mean, honestly, I don't think most of us think about terrorism anymore. We're so divided right now amongst ourselves that we've forgotten about international terrorism.
For me, it was more personal than political, just because of the fact that I felt like I had an obligation to do something, and that's why I was there.
19 years after I met him in the control tower at Bagram Airfield, Taylor invited me to visit with him at his suburban Chicago home.
I think when I showed up there, it might have been a little over 100, but when I left, I think there might have been about 8,000 people, maybe 9,000.
Taylor served in Afghanistan for almost a year, also later deploying to Iraq.
This was the unit, the F-15 unit out of Oregon.
Before retiring, he received one of the highest honors in the U.S. Air Force, the Air National Guard Senior Non-Commissioned Officer of the Year Award. Today, he works for the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, and watched the fall of the Afghan government and the loss of U.S. strategic resources, including Bagram Airfield, unfold in recent weeks.
I thought we'd be there forever.
Taylor says the current circumstance in Afghanistan does little to change the way he views how he and his fellow military members serve their country.
Me, I'm glad I got to go. At the time, I think it was worth it. I still do, but I'm sure I would get a good argument from a lot of people.
It's an argument that policymakers, politicians, historians, and voters will also debate for decades to come, as the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan closed amid the chaotic and dangerous evacuation of tens of thousands of U.S. citizens, troops, and their allies at the Kabul airport. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
Thank you for listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can also find us on Instagram, YouTube, and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gell. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Amy Hybels, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Chris Cascao in Washington. Enjoy the day. Be well and stay safe.